This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Shashi Tharoor, spends his days trying to keep peace in the world. In his spare time, he writes novels about India, where he grew up. He's the special assistant to the Undersecretary General of the UN, charged with peacekeeping operations. Tharoor is the team leader of the operation in the former Yugoslavia. We invited him to talk with us about his new novel and his work at the UN, although he cautioned us that the peacekeeping work is of such a sensitive nature that he can't say much about it publicly. Tharoor's new satirical novel, Show Business, is set in India's film industry, which cranks out a huge number of gaudy escapist movies. The main character is an actor who tries to bring 20th century Western classics to the Indian stage, but no one's interested and he's broke, so he enters the movie industry and surprisingly becomes a big star. His popularity leads him into politics, which gives Tharoor the opportunity to make connections between the phoniness of politics and show business. Here's a reading from the opening of Show Business.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Me, Ashok Banjara, product of the finest public school in independent India, secretary of the Shakespeare Society at St. Francis's College, no less, not to mention son of the Minister of State for Minor Textiles, chasing an aging actress around a papier-mâché tree in an artificial drizzle, lip-syncing to the tinny inanities of an aspiring and highly aspirating playback singer. But it is me, it's my mouth that's moving in soundless ardour, it's my feet that are scudding treeward in faithful obeisance to the unlikely choreography of the dance director. Move, step, turn, as sari-clad Abha, yesterday's heartthrob, old enough to be my mother and just about beginning to show it, nimbly evades my practiced lunge and runs, famous bust out-thrust, to the temporary shelter of an improbably leafy branch. I follow, head tilted back, arms outstretched, pretending to sing. I shall always chase you to the ends of the earth. I want to embrace you from Pahalgam to Perth, my love. My arms encircle her, but as my fingertips meet, she ducks, dancing, and slips out of my clutches, pirouetting gaily away. Drenched chiffon clings to the pointed cones of her blouse, but she raises one end of the soaked sari pallav to half cover her face, holding the edge across the bridge of her perfect nose in practiced coyness. Her large eyes imprison me, then blink in release. Despite myself, I marvel. She has done this for 20 years. It is my first attempt. I shall always chase you from now till my rebirth, and it's only when I face you that I feel I know my worth, my love. I shall always chase you, I'll never feel the dearth of my desire to lace you around my... Cut! I'm caught in mid-gesture, mid-movement, mid-word. The playback track screeches to a stop. I freeze, feeling as foolish as I imagine I must look. Abha snaps her irritation, turns away.
And that's Shashi Tharoor reading from his new novel, Show Business. You know, I think it's amazing to most Americans that India has a larger film industry than America does. Tell me why you wanted to set your novel in the Indian film industry.
Well, I've been very concerned with the kinds of stories that a society tells about itself. That was the implicit theme of my first novel, The Great Indian Novel, in which I attempted something slightly more ambitious, perhaps, in retelling the political history of 20th century India through a reinterpretation of events and episodes and characters from our 2,000-year-old epic, the Mahabharat. Here, instead of taking the myths and legends of our ancient past, I've taken some of the modern myths, if you like, the escapist myths that are portrayed and churned out every day for the edification of India's masses. And let's not forget, India is a country where half the population is still illiterate and where cinema remains in many ways the principal source of entertainment for the vast majority of our people. So the stories, the ambience, the films themselves in every respect contribute to a great extent to people's perceptions, both of the world around them, of what might be, and of what they want to escape to when they turn away from the world immediately around them.
So what are some of the time-tested stories that the movies tell and retell and tell again?
Well, I should stress that in this novel I'm concerned primarily with the sort of formulaic B-movie type popular film made by Bombay, made by Bollywood, as it's irreverently called. These films are, as I say, stereotyped. They have the inevitable, you know, rich boy meets poor girl or poor boy meets rich girl formula. There's several stories featuring separated twins or separated siblings, one of whom, you know, grows up as a policeman, the other one as a cop, and I mean as a crook, and they meet at some climactic moment three-fourths of the way through the movie. There's fairly simple juxtapositions of good and evil, evil being personalized usually in the individual of played by the villain. And there are actors who made entire careers out of doing nothing but playing villains, just as there are others who made entire careers out of playing heroes. And it's very rarely that a hero can descend into villainy or a villain become a hero once he's been fixed in the public imagination as a villain. It's formulaic, but it's essentially fun, and often in the old cliche, good clean fun, because a lot of the more explicit natures of human interaction are left out of Hindi films. I mean, kissing was only permitted very recently and doesn't happen too often yet. But there's a lot that's suggested, that there's a lot that sparks off the imagination. There's lots of songs and music and dance, by the way, the infusion of these traditional folk elements into this modern Western medium, the cinema. So all of this combined to create an artificial world, a world which really bears no relation to anything that anyone watching that movie is ever likely to encounter in real life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shashi Tharoor, and his new novel, Show Business, is set in India, in the Indian film industry. You're involved both with literature and politics. You studied at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy in the United States. You now work with the UN, with the peacekeeping force in Yugoslavia. And you're a novelist. What has kept you with one foot in the world of the arts and the other foot in the world of politics?
A very uncomfortable posture, I can tell you. Well, the fact is that I see myself in many ways as a human being with a number of concerns about the world, some of which I express in my work, which was for refugees for 11 and a half years before I moved to peacekeeping, and some of which I express through my writing, both fiction in the novels and short stories I've written, and non-fiction in the shape of a scholarly book I produced and articles occasionally in the mass media. So I try to, if you like, express my reactions to the world in both sets of ways. Increasingly, of course, it becomes difficult to juggle both identities. And indeed, as a person with a family, I have twin boys who are now 8 and demand more and more of what little leisure time I have. I'm discovering that it's not always easy to keep one foot on both stools. One starts slipping and you find the fall can be quite precipitous. But I do feel that as far as possible and to the extent I can, I would like to sustain both identities, both roles, both lives. I'm immensely challenged by what I'm doing. I work as Special Assistant to the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, and though I'm supposed to have a finger in all the various peacekeeping pies around the world, the one which specifically is on my plate is the very difficult operation in Yugoslavia. And it's not one which has been replete with satisfactions for us. We've worked very long hours and many seven-day weeks on end without being able to feel that we have made the kind of difference that we would have liked to have been able to make. But we haven't given up by a long chalk, and though tragedies continue in many ways, we do have the sense that some of what our peacekeeping force in that area is doing has created a situation that's better than what might obtain if we weren't there. It's not saying a lot, but it's something.
I know that you wish not to talk about most of the work that you're doing with the peacekeeping force, but I wonder if you could tell us something about the nature of the process that you're working with.
Well, I went out to Yugoslavia during the conflict last year with the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, and my boss, Undersecretary General Goulding, and on several other visits to help negotiate the plan that the United Nations has attempted to implement in Croatia. And I've been out there on subsequent trips, both to brief some of the soldiers we sent out to start implementing this work, and to see how things were getting along, and indeed then to watch, sadly, the descent into anarchy in Bosnia, which wasn't even an initial target of our plan. Here at headquarters, there's an awful lot to be done with the Security Council, with the representatives of the very many governments that have an intimate interest in what's going on out there, and in dealing with the press and non-governmental organizations, various members of the public who are trying to pursue this matter. So while by being here, I no longer have the kind of hands-on role I had as we were beginning to set up this operation when I made 7 or 8 visits in the first 8 or 9 months of that operation, I am intimately involved with every aspect of what we are experiencing out there, and it's my responsibility to help manage that operation from headquarters.
What's it been like for you emotionally to be in a country, the United States, that's not at war, trying to come up with a plan for peace in a country that is at war?
It's been wrenching in many ways, Terry, and particularly so because there's so much in Yugoslavia that's unlike many of the other countries in which I have worked for both refugees and now in peacekeeping. It's a country which in several respects has all the attributes, all the appearances of a developed Western country, very much like the one in which I happen to be living now. And it's very strange when you see people in jeans and denim jackets and Reebok shoes running for cover from snipers. It's not quite the same thing as the images of horror and deprivation that that we have all become used to seeing from less fortunate parts of the world. Here is a society which in so many respects would appear to have the trappings of what the world understands by modernity. And it's caught up in this grotesque, inhumane, savage conflict, which, for lack of a better word, is a tribal war. And that dissonance between the appearance of the societies, of the society itself, and the nature of what's going on in there, I think particularly drives home to you what is the tragedy you're witnessing.
The UN has peacekeeping operations in 13 countries, 47,000 troops are involved. How optimistic are you that UN peacekeeping can really be effective in keeping international peace?
Well, peacekeeping has worked remarkably well in a number of situations around the world over the years, but it has always required the existence of a peace to be kept. In other words, peacekeeping goes in when the parties to a conflict want the United Nations to come in and help them to uphold an agreement that they've reached. It requires the consent of the parties to the conflict and their active cooperation. The problem we're finding increasingly, though, is that UN peacekeeping operations are being thrust into situations where these basics don't always exist, and where very often the clamour goes up for the UN to do something, what that something is not always carefully defined. So peacekeeping can only go in to do what the Security Council authorizes and mandates it to do. It is not peace enforcement, as many editorial writers mistakenly seem to think. And so what it can do is really help parties to achieve something that they're willing to achieve. It's very difficult for a peacekeeping force to enforce a peace if the parties to a particular conflict do not want peace.
You've been living away from India for many years and working with the United Nations, but both of your novels are set in India. You were educated, well, you got your PhD at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy, mm-hmm. in Tufts University in the United States. Mm-hmm. Did you ever plan to return to India after you came to the States for your doctorate?
Very much so, and it's a plan I haven't entirely given up yet. But I found myself far too involved in the work I've been doing, which has kept me outside India, and that's made it difficult to go back. I do try and manage a visit every year, often for as long as a month or even slightly more if I can manage it every year. And my parents still live there, and I have a lot of friends whom I keep close touch with. I am very concerned about events in India. It's the defining experience of my life was growing up in India and confronting the various issues which the challenges that India face give rise to in any thinking person's mind. And therefore, India matters a great deal to me, and I'd like very much to matter to India.
You must have such a truly international scope on things. You're an Indian living in the United States, working at the United Nations, mm-hmm. and working now with the peacekeeping team for Yugoslavia. So, I mean, your eyes are on all different parts of the world at once.
That's true, and it's something which I think an Indian upbringing uniquely fits you for. You know, when you grew up in India, especially because 200 years of British rule left us with one good thing, their language, you do have access to a great deal of international information, consciousness of what's happening in the rest of the world, and an exposure to it without at the same time being separated from the Indian roots that give you a sense of your identity and of the nature of life that is very different from what you might acquire growing up in the developed English-speaking world. So coming from India, having lived in India, but at the same time having had one's mind shaped and quickened by the opportunities provided by information and knowledge from the rest of the world, you do find yourself able in the international arena to put your to serve the interests of these different causes without seeing any inherent contradiction in them.
Shashi Tharoor is the author of the new novel Show Business. He's special assistant to the Undersecretary General of the UN, charged with peacekeeping operations. Milo Miles reviews new music from Tanzania after this short break. This is Fresh Air.